Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 1:35 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time, and today is October 30th. It's the last day of the month, and it's also Friday, so it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Now, I thought we'd kick off with the yield curve, because it is now back above 70 basis points. I'd also like to pivot and spend more time thinking about what's going on in China, and how that is tying into everything else that's happening in the world, and then perhaps think about the US presidential election and the coronavirus as well. But when we look at the yield curve spread, we can see that there's a clear cyclicality. It tends to surge higher after a recession. And subsequently, when the recession has pretty much bottomed out, then we start to see the yield curve compressing again. The reason the yield curve tends to move higher following a recession is because central banks cut interest rates, and then that creates a steep yield curve, which means that there is a big divergence between the short end and the long end of the curve. That helps to rescue the banking sector. They start to lend again. That increases economic activity with the credit impetus. Then you start to see inflationary pressures rising, so they start raising interest rates again. They raise rates until they break something. You get another recession. Interest rates are cut to the bone again, and the whole cycle starts afresh. Well, we've just had an inverted yield curve back last year. Now, the difference between the 10-year and the 2-year is less sensitive than the difference between the 3-month and the 10-year. The 3-month 10-year spread was inverted in May. The 10-year 2-year spread was inverted right at the end of August. It's a reliable lead indicator for future recessions. At least in my experience, every single time there has been an inversion of the yield curve, there is a vociferous argument about why this time is different. And back in 2005 and 2006, it was because of the advent of China and the fact that that was a deflationary force. And more recently, it was because of the very low interest rate environment and that it was almost impossible to have or to really gain any kind of benefit from looking at an inverted yield curve because interest rates were so low already that it didn't make a lot of sense. And yet we've had the recession. Now, aside from the exogenous factors like the bursting of the subprime lending market in the USA or the pandemic this year, the reality is that it is a reliable lead indicator. It does not tell us where the epicenter of risk is going to be, but it is certainly an indicator that liquidity is tightening, and therefore wherever liquidity or wherever business models have been most heavily dependent on leverage, well, then that tightening up of interest rates and the reduction of access to liquidity then generally tends to put pressure on those leveraged businesses, and that's where the epicenter of risk emerges. Well, now the question is, are we going to see a steepening of the yield curve again? Because it generally tends to peak, or at least it has peaked, in the region of about 250 basis points between the period of 1992 through to the peaks in about 2014-15. If we are in fact going to see that, well then we would have to see a very meaningful change in the government bond yield, and it could rise in the order of about 175 basis points, and coming up off the lows, that would represent more than 200 basis points of tightening. 200 basis points of tightening for the US government would be approximately $100 billion worth of expenditure on interest expense every year, considering that the considering that the education budget, for example, is $74 billion, that's an extraordinary sum of money that would have to come out of some form of government program. Well, obviously, there's just a very difficult decision that has to be made in that case. Either there's going to have to be significant cuts to government spending in order to meet that interest expense, or growth and the government income from taxation would have to increase by the extra $100 billion. Well, that could be achieved through growth, or it could be achieved through higher taxation, but is unlikely to be achieved by both. And then there is the potential that they will simply print the money. And that is where we are in terms of this increasing willingness to accept modern monetary theory. So we're at a critical juncture here, because if we simply just zoom in and look at what in fact has been going on this year, every time the yield curve spread got up to 70 basis points, it was knocked straight back down. And that happened again last week. When I was recording the video last week, it was right in the region of 70 basis points. And on Monday, we had action to pull it back down again. And now, as we were back on another Friday, the yield curve is, at this time, it's at a higher high. So we still have higher highs and higher lows. Well, we may yet have additional measures to bring it back down again on Monday. What is particularly interesting is that the Federal Reserve has said in plain English that they are not engaged in yield curve control. But until this week or last week, the market has been behaving as if they are. Now, I thought that this was a particularly interesting graphic, and it shows a loose correlation between M1 and money supply growth and the 10-year, 2-year spread. Well, money supply growth has exploded on the upside this year. It was in direct response to the massive decline in the velocity of money. But the reality is that there is a loose correlation between the yield curve spread and M1 expansion. And of course, we know what the reason for that is. It's simple, that you wouldn't have this kind of M1 expansion were it not for a grave economic risk. And obviously, we've had that in terms of the global market activity this year. But it does suggest that we should expect to see a pop higher in the yield curve. Well, if that's the case, well, what then could we expect? Either we're going to see a significant move higher in 10-year government bond yields, and or the alternative is that the 2-year yield would have to drop lower. Of course, it's a spread, so it could be one or both. Either 10-year yields move higher faster than 2-year yields, or 2-year yields fall faster than 10-year yields. But when we look at the price chart, well, it looks like a base formation. One of the defining and most attractive characteristics of any base formation is that it's well-defined, and then we start to see sequences of higher reaction lows inside the base before the breakout. Well, we've seen that. The 10-year yield has been holding a sequence of higher reaction lows since August, and it's now back above the trend mean and at a new closing high for at least the last 5 months. It could pull straight back down again on Friday. But the other interesting point is that we've had some profound moves in the 10-year chart over the course of the last 3 decades. And it has certainly accelerated lower this year and from the peak back at the end of 2018. So there is obviously, there's been a massive surge in demand for bonds, but the great challenge with investing in bonds is that the more demand there is, the more supply there is. The more supply there is, the less creditworthy the seller of the debt is going to be. But because it is then the most liquid market, it tends to have the greatest amount of liquidity. And often investors prize liquidity over creditworthiness. So then you have the paradox that the least creditworthy issues tend to have the most liquidity. And back in just ahead of the credit crisis, it was some of the least creditworthy issuers had the most liquid bonds. And I'm really thinking about a number of the Landesbanks in Germany, like Hypovereinsbank, had its own yield curve. So did General Motors and Ford. They were running extraordinarily leveraged balance sheets, and there were clear business model problems. For example, General Motors was not making any money on its cars. It relied on its finance unit to generate all of its profits, and that wasn't seen as problematic. But when liquidity became an issue, when money market funds started breaking the buck and the commercial paper market collapsed, then they ran into significant problems because they were funding their entire business operation on overnight money. And that was obviously a problem, and it became very problematic. But the risk today is in the highly liquid bond markets of sovereigns, where there is massive liquidity, incredible credit risk, and this clear willingness to continue to expand their deficits. And if we think about why are these bond yields starting to move higher, well, it's because of the clear intention of governments to run spectacular deficits. When we look at the GDP forecasts for 2020, it's only China is expected to, in fact, grow this year. And then as we move progressively down, the USA is expected to have a contraction of about 3.5%, Germany in excess of 5%, Japan well in excess of 5%, but Russia more like 7%, France closer to 10%, and the UK at 10%. Same with India and more in Italy. So that's obviously something that we should be paying some form of attention to. But then when we think about what is expected for next year, well, in the USA, for example, they are thinking that or what the market is pricing in is at least a 2.25 trillion deficit and potentially 2.75. Well, that's still a spectacular amount of money, and the bond market is beginning to price that in, that there is the clear willingness by government, whoever wins the election, to run extraordinarily large deficits, and that this is going to be a factor for successive governments because populations are done with accepting austerity. They're also done with funding bailouts for banks and for companies with and then populations being expected to foot the bill. And there is obviously this clear rise in populism, and we've had a significant move in populism from the right, which has primarily focused on lowering taxes, but we are increasingly looking at the possibility of a lurch to the left, which will be more about putting money in the hands of people, whether that is in terms of universal basic income, whether it is in terms of dispossessing richer people and putting their money in the hands of poorer people, so wealth taxes or property taxes or high or second home taxes. These are all possibilities with left-leaning administrations. But one way or the other, it means that we're likely to have a much wider deficits. And then you have also got the vanity projects like the green new deals. Japan, China, Europe have all said that they are looking to become carbon neutral by 2050. That represents 40 something percent of all of carbon emissions in the world. Under a Democrat administration in the USA, it's likely that there would also be a Green New Deal adopted. They will sign back up for the Paris Accords. That doesn't really mean much to the USA. They're already meeting the requirements for that, but they would probably then also go further and go for carbon neutral by 2050 as well. So that's also representative of a lurch towards the left, that you do tend to get these vanity projects that are extraordinarily expensive. So this also represents a massive source of additional spending. And then the question obviously has to arise, how is it going to be paid for? How are these debts going to be serviced? Is there any intention by governments to service those debts? And this really is the big question, because the bond market is, and yields are so incredibly low, and we have to also remain, I think, cognizant of the fact that emotions tend to run high in the bond market, just as much as they do in the stock market. People are people regardless of what asset class they are dealing with. Back at the end of 2018, there was a consensus that we were going to see a new inflationary cycle, and that yields were starting to push higher, and that they were going to trend higher, that it was going to represent a transition in terms of the way that debts are being funded. And subsequently, yields fell from 3.25 to approximately 50 basis points. At that point, there was a consensus that the entire sovereign bond market was going to have negative yields. Well, we're still at a point where Europe has got the majority of negative yielding debt, and it's still in the region of about 17 trillion. And the quantity of bonds that have got negative yields looks like it's going to break out. So there is a clear knock-on effect from the EU that with negative deposit rates and zero interest rates, then they have got this negative yield environment, which is pretty much taking away the funding pressure on EU governments. When, for example, we look at Italy's government bond yields, they're at 76 basis points. Now, it has risen, and it was up 6 basis points in here today. But it is basically saying that on a constant currency basis, that the credit or the return that you can get from Italian debt and the risks involved in that are similar to those that you get from buying 10-year US treasuries. Now, there's obviously some kind of contradiction in that kind of way of thinking, and yet it is the reality. And government bond yields in Italy today are at lows that haven't been seen in years. In fact, we have to go. We are at a point today where Italy can borrow at levels that it's never seen before. So there is the additional point, though, that Europe as a whole has got a debt to GDP ratio in the region of about 80%. Obviously, Italy has got a debt to GDP ratio well in excess of 100%, and the same is true of Cyprus, of Greece, and also of France. But as a whole, and if we start to think about where is the future, what is the future for the Eurozone? Well, it's in a federal, or it's likely to result in a federal union. with mutualization of debt. And with mutualization of debt, then the entire Eurozone's debt to GDP ratio would fall back below 100% because of the relative size of the German market and a number of the other creditor nations. Well, then that would put Europe in a more sustainable debt environment, particularly relative to other countries. And the USA is obviously an example of somewhere where the debt to GDP ratio is trending higher and is expected to continue to trend higher. Well, obviously, this represents a competitive question. Shouldn't the dollar, therefore, be trending downwards? And particularly versus the euro. But it isn't. And the reason that it isn't right now is because of the coronavirus and the lockdown measures that are being deployed in Europe in order to combat it. And we had a lockstep move in terms of the demand for the dollar back in March when lockdowns were initiated. Then money flew out of Europe and into the US dollar and out of assets everywhere and into cash. And that helped to sustain the dollar. So the dollar is strengthening in here right now as the European markets trend lower. Having rebounded to test the region of the trend mean, they broke downwards in here this week. So now the question is, when are we going to get aggressive new measures to stimulate the economy? Because if they simply lock down without lending additional assistance, then that is only going to exacerbate the pressure on an additional economic contraction. So that's what the stock market is pricing in this week. Europe certainly doesn't want to have a strong currency. So the ECB decided this week that they were going to boost the quantity of money that they are willing to use to support the economy, and that they'll start doing that in December. But the number of cases, hospitalizations, and deaths from the coronavirus is trending higher in Europe today. And that is why the stock market is pulling back, because the measures that have been announced are in the future. The problem is in real time. So that is putting downward pressure on the European stock markets. But it's also putting downward pressure on the euro. I think, well, instead of first looking at China, let's then look at the yen. The Japanese have certainly been more successful in combating the coronavirus than elsewhere, but the economy is still recovering, but the yen is not appreciating. In fact, it's pulling back from the 104 level. Generally, it's seen as a safe haven currency, but it is not rallying right now. Japan doesn't want a stronger currency. They've been defending this 104 level now for a reasonably prolonged period of time. It's years in the making, even though there is a clear downward bias to this trend since 2015. They don't seem willing to allow the yen to strengthen through 104. Then I think it's also interesting that they also in Japan said that they want to have zero interest rates, but we continue to see upward pressure on yields, and they've been holding it below 0.1% for the last 4 years. It looks like there's continued upward pressure on Japanese bonds. Investors internationally are beginning to take notice of the fact that China has got substantially higher yields than just about everywhere else. And they're currently at around 3.2%. So the yield is trending higher. It's broken its sequence of higher reaction lows. And what it is pricing in is that China is going to raise interest rates, or at least that China is going to be the first country to raise interest rates. The yuan has been trending higher now since June. When we then think about the outlook for the renminbi versus the yen, for example, it hasn't quite yet broken up out of this downtrend, but it is looking increasingly likely that it will. When we look at the yuan versus the euro, it hasn't broken the sequence of lower rally highs yet either, but it's increasingly likely that it will. And of course, it has clearly broken, or I should put it the other way around, it has clearly broken its downtrend against the US dollar. And when the renminbi strengthens against major currencies, that allows other Asian currencies to also appreciate. They peg themselves in terms of competitiveness versus the renminbi. When the renminbi strengthens, it allows them to also allow their currencies to appreciate. So, for example, the Taiwan dollar has been strengthening through to levels not seen since at least 2011. And while we have short-term overbought conditions for many of these currencies, the reality is that we're seeing a substantial re-rating. It's exactly the same thing for the Korean won. The Philippine peso has been one of the strongest currencies in the region over the course of the last year and has been rising steadily. It's still coming off of a very depressed level overall. And when we start to think then about where opportunities are likely to be, well, it's quite likely that we're in a redux of the kind of fears that evolved in the aftermath of the tech bust in the early 2000s. It was back then that people were worried about the possibility that we would have financialization of debt. And obviously, we're in a much more exaggerated period right now where the quantity of money that's been printed in the intervening 17 years has been beyond the imagination of anyone, really. But yet, we're still in this financial repression kind of environment. And when the dollar trended downwards, that was when it was a clear response to the advent of China onto the global stage. Now, it would be easy to conclude that China is not going to build a new Manhattan every month in the next decade. But they do still represent a very significant source of demand for commodities. And what we're much more likely to see as response to the pandemic is infrastructure growth on a scale similar to what China did in the last decade, but spread out internationally, because everywhere is going to want to build infrastructure, whether that is in India to build ports and roads and manufacturing capacity in order to employ the millions, or really hundreds of millions, of young people entering the workforce over the next decade, whether that's in the ASEAN region in order to boost their competitiveness and ability to pick up some of the lower-end jobs that will migrate from China as it moves up the value chain, whether that's going to be in Africa to kickstart their manufacturing, very low-end manufacturing, and that's already well underway, or it's going to be in the renewal of infrastructure in places like Europe and North America, where a lot of the infrastructure that was built after the Second World War has used the, or at least reached the end of its useful life, so it needs to be replaced. And that is before we even begin to think about the quantity of infrastructure in the energy sector that would be required to be built if countries and regions are in fact serious about meeting their goals of being carbon free or neutral by 2050. We're talking about spending in the order of 100 trillion. If we think about how much money is going to have to pour into infrastructure development. So that represents massive spending. And the creditor nations of the world are in a better position to fund that kind of spending, and particularly those with a demographic dividend will be in a better position to benefit from the growth that that kind of spending will engender. So those are, I think, some of the factors behind why we continue to see strength coming through in a number of the higher growth, younger population countries of the world. Then when we think about the outlook for commodity producers, the South African rand has strengthened through its 200-day moving average. The Australian dollar has also broken its more than two-year downtrend and is consolidating right now. When we think about the Canadian dollar, it's been really quite steady over the course of the last few years. But the likelihood is that these currencies will do better as long as the industrial resources continue to trend higher. Well, obviously, in the short term, we have got some significant challenges because of the coronavirus and the response to it, and particularly if that inhibits global growth. But as we look into 2021, well, we know, for example, that Pfizer expects to have results from its phase 3 trial in the next 2 weeks. So that was one of the reasons why the share has started to steady again in here today. Then when we think about Moderna, it's another one of the companies that has been associated with providing a successful vaccine. Well, the share has done spectacularly well as it priced in that eventuality all the way up to the peak in July. Since then, it has been going sideways. The reality is that when we start to think about the potential for manufacturing vaccines, then if we add it all together, it could be as many as 7 billion doses produced internationally next year. That really means that anyone who wants a vaccine will get one. It also means that all we have to do is wait, that there is the clear potential that we're coming to the end of this incredibly difficult year, that good news is on the horizon. But of course, until we in fact have the good news, then it's too early to call the all clear. And the reality is that we're in a historical environment. And there is no evidence of rationality in terms of how governments are responding to the threat. If we were to really consider where the risks are concentrated, then it would be rational to put most of the resources into looking after elderly people. And yet we are looking at blanket lockdowns. And these are obviously going to be significant in terms of the impact that it has on the economy. When we also look at the initial measures that were introduced, a lot of them are starting to expire, and particularly the moratorium on evictions will expire at the end of this year. Well, if we're not fully open, then those will have to be extended. There will have to be additional money spent, and there will have to be some measures underway to try and depress government bond yields. Well, against that background, on a comparative advantage basis, China is looking to be coming out of this crisis in a stronger position. And the fact that the bond market is pricing in that they may be the first country to raise interest rates is certainly supportive of that. When we then think about the technology sector, well, the Chinese market has been very active in terms of the 5-year plans and the success thereof, and that has helped to really create a great deal of confidence that they will be able to follow through on their determination to create, for example, a semiconductor, I guess, domestic sector. When we think about the semiconductor market, they're still way behind, but the reality is that they're willing to throw as much money at this problem as possible, or as is needed, because it's a national security priority. They've spent much of the last decade creating a domestic demand economy, and that's been successful, and that will continue. They've also spent a great deal of money on enhancing domestic security to clamp down on any kind of potential protest, and it has been incredibly draconian, but it has also been successful. Then they are still attempting to introduce social programs like a basic form of health insurance and basic pension reforms. When we start to think about the measures that China took in order to promote growth was to break the iron rice bowl and to take the support networks that the government provided to people. Taking them away was one of the primary steps taken to liberalization and to the growth of the economy. Now they're trying to reintroduce those measures on a limited basis in order to create or to spread the benefit of a modestly well-off society. So China is definitely now a middle-income country on a per capita basis. What is it that they need to do in order to become the true global superpower that they want to be, both in terms of international standing, influence, and GDP per capita? Well, obviously, with a population of over 1 billion people, GDP per capita is something that is very difficult to achieve on an equal basis. But the introduction of social programs at least helps to spread that net somewhat wider. Then there will be clear intentions to upskill the economy. So there are massive investments going into everything that could potentially boost growth in future, whether it is investing in green technology today or investing in quantum computing. They put a probe on the far side of the moon just this year, so there's a lot of money moving into space technology. China now also has reusable rockets, so they are mirroring the kind of innovation that companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin were able to develop. There is obviously then the clear intention to be the leader in all forms of artificial intelligence, and that's really just the beginning. But the more important point is that with the higher interest rate and the stronger currency and the potential for growth and the willingness to invest in a big way in new technologies, then that is attractive to international investors. And international investors will look the other way in terms of human rights if they believe that they can get the returns that are required to meet their mandates. So that represents a really quite large existential threat to the ability of Western governments to attract the capital that they require, because the spending programs that are evolving in North America and in Europe are extraordinarily large, and they don't have a ready strategy for how to pay for it. And that's the primary reason why gold prices continue to rally. So we're at a point now where gold has been pulling back for 3 months. Part of the reason that it's been pulling back was because of Turkey in particular selling gold. And let me see if I can find that chart. So we saw, for example, that central bank holdings of gold have risen every year since the peak of the gold bull market and pulled back slightly this year. Well, a good part of that reason was because of Turkey selling. And we had an accelerated move up to the peak in August, and we've had a relatively mild consolidation since then. Prices were a little steadier in here today, and most of the overextension relative to the trend mean has been unwound. This doesn't look like anything other than a consolidation following an impressive breakout. I think that the purchasing power parity of gold chart is by far the most instructive in terms of the rationale for why someone would want to own gold. Because, yes, the price has been consolidating over the course of the last 3 months. But the other point, of course, is that it has been ranging for a very prolonged period of time, and the peak back in 2011 approximated the peak from back in 1980. Following that, we've had a 10-year process of consolidation, and now we're getting just a pause in the region of that peak, because it's quite likely that we're going to see gold break out to new highs on a purchasing power parity basis. Now, whether that happens in 2020 or 2021 is still open to interpretation, or to a guess at least. One thing we certainly know about gold is that it does tend to range for prolonged periods of time. In fact, ranges that were relatively lengthy were at one of the hallmarks of the bull market in the period up from 2000. And it did go sideways for 18 months at a time. And then it broke out in the Septembers of uneven years. And then that changed. But it was in the latter half of the bull market, really just in the last few years up to the peak, when the trend became much more consistent. Well, when trends go from inconsistent to consistent, it's generally an indication that the imbalance between supply and demand is becoming wider. In other words, that buyers are heavily dominant and they change the consistency of the trend. Well, we're just not anywhere close to that kind of environment today yet, but it is quite likely out there in the future. The longer that prices hold around the $1,900 area, the greater the likelihood it is that gold miners will be able to introduce dividends. The Gold Miners ETF found support this week in the region of the previous peak, but also the region of the 200-day moving average. It's so far held this impressive breakout from what is effectively a more than 6-year base formation, and it's still in a recovery scenario. I certainly think that by the time this bull market has run its course, we will see the ETF trading at well in excess of the peaks put in back in 2011. And I think the reason for that is because the gold mining sector is or has been through a phenomenal rationalization, and they have a newfound respect for cash flow, and they're not spending a lot of money on exploration. They're not spending a lot of money on expansion either. Where there is M&A activity is between existing miners, but that does not increase overall supply. So we're definitely seeing a great deal of focus on profits from the gold mining sector. And that is something that will eventually be appreciated by investors. And when we then think about some of the rationale, well, the dividend yield might only be a half of 1%, but the other point is that dividend growth from gold miners was 81% over the course of the last year. And dividend growth is where you start to get re-rating of companies. So when they start to increase their dividends, or when they commit themselves to increasing their dividend in line with their profits, or that they will match the moves in the gold price with increases in their dividends. These are the kinds of strategies that really do start to fire the imagination of investors. Newmont is one of those companies where they've tied the dividend to the gold price, and it's bouncing today from, or yesterday, from the region of the trend mean. Now, that doesn't mean that we're not going to have volatility in future. The fact that we are seeing rising cases. Now, the rationale for why that's happening, and the fact that lots of people decided they were going to go on vacation in August, and then they brought the infections home with them, that's the reason why we're getting more cases right now. We're also, of course, testing more, but I think it is time to at least pay at some due consideration to the fact that the number of cases rising outstrips the percentage gain in the number of tests being performed. And then, of course, we have the number of hospitalizations are rising and the number of deaths are rising. They're not rising in an exponential fashion, but they are rising. So that this is the time to take more remedial action, and it is a source of potential volatility. But I would think that there is something that is worth considering, that when we think about commodity demand growth, there are important considerations. The first is that as China moves further up the value chain in terms of manufacturing, then it's even less, more or less likely to be independent from imports of food. So, particularly soybeans. And soybean deficit, the soybean deficit has been increasing for all of the last decade, and it's likely to increase even further in here over the next few years. It's exactly the same with corn. Wheat seems to be less of a factor, and the same with rice. Then when we think about protein, well, it looks to be quite clear that there is a demand growth cycle in beef, also in pork, and obviously there is a significant deficit in pork in 2020 because of the swine flu. But there are clear measures underway to try and increase the pork herd. So this suggests that China is going to be importing a substantial number of commodities for the foreseeable future. Then we also have the fact that it's really only in the last 6 years that China has started to become a significant consumer of coffee. The vast majority of China's consumption of coffee is instant. But anyone who gets used to drinking coffee will quickly migrate to better quality coffee. And that would appear to also be quite likely for China. So we're at a point where there is potential, at least, for commodity demand growth to be a significant factor for the Chinese market. When we look at global consumption of metals, well, China represents approximately 56% of aluminium, more than 50% of copper, more than 50% of steel, not in terms of production, but in terms of consumption. Also, it's a bigger consumer of oil now than the USA, or it will be soon. And then it's one of the bigger producers of gold. China's demand growth for oil is likely to be one of the primary reasons why they are so eager to become carbon neutral by 2050. Because if they really do want to become the global superpower and to overcome the USA, then they are going to try everything they can to reduce their consumption of oil. But that's going to be difficult, because as they move progressively further up the value chain, then per capita consumption of key industrial resources increases. They're certainly building out their 5G infrastructure, that's pretty much done, but there will be additional calls on infrastructure development, and most particularly in next generation technology. If we think, for example, that China is going to decide that all their vehicles are going to be electric vehicles by the year 2050, the recharging network for all those vehicles would represent a massive call on copper. If we think about the fact that in order for every car in the UK to be an electric vehicle, it would require all of the copper production for the entire globe in a year. So if we start to then think about exactly what it means in order to really boost the chances of becoming carbon neutral, the quantity of carbon that would have to be produced in order to achieve that goal is probably a multiple of what is produced on an annual basis today. And that is not something that the green advocates seem to be willing to talk about at all. The mining of copper, aluminium, and lithium is something that is going to have to expand in an exponential manner in order to achieve some of these goals that are being enunciated in various election campaigns. For example, Albemarle trended downwards from 2017 all the way through until March of this year, and it's really now only just beginning to do better. The oversupply of lithium following the massive investments in additional supply is probably only just now starting to be taken up by the market, and we're going to need to see additional investment in new lithium supply if we're in fact going to meet the kinds of demand growth forecasts that the majority of governments are now introducing. Oro Cambre, for example, is still right in the region of its lows, and it hasn't really traded in anywhere above this level, it hasn't been able to pull away from this level for more than a year. But if we're in fact going to get this kind of demand growth for electric vehicles, it's inevitable that there will be additional demand. Copper prices are still really doing reasonably steady action and are still holding the $3 area. Well, obviously there is a near-term risk from the coronavirus, but the medium-term risk is on the upside. Then when we think about soybeans, well, the price had been going sideways for a prolonged period, and every time it has popped on the upside, it has come straight back down again. So now, having successfully pushed above the 1,000-cent level, it's going to have to hold that move. The Arabica coffee price is still in the region of the 100-cent level. This is also one of the largest contracts internationally. I think the only one bigger is in terms of the volume or the size of contracts is oil. But the price is still holding around the 100-cent level. But there's a secular demand growth story in terms of Chinese consumption of coffee, in the same way that we have consumption of soybeans or consumption of the primary proteins. Then when we think about the parallels in terms of social unrest that we have today with what happened in the 1960s, well, lumber is potentially a beneficiary from that. There was a massive building boom in the 1970s to basically civilize all those protesters by giving them mortgages. And there is nothing will make you a responsible adult more than the milestone or the millstone of having to carry a mortgage obligation. Well, that suggests that there's going to be an awful lot of home building going on. And that is also one of the key measures that any government can take in order to really help people to come to terms with the lower standard of living that they've had to endure as a result of their government promoting world peace. At the end of the Cold War, there was this clear intention to really help everyone that had been living on a subsistence life all over the world to achieve a middle-class lifestyle. It was never enunciated to the many middle-class people in the developed world that they were going to be sacrificed in order to achieve that goal. So we have successfully lifted billions of people out of poverty and into the middle classes. But what has also result or been the clear result was that there were millions of people in Europe and North America that lost their means of achieving a middle class lifestyle. The kind of jobs that they depended on now have disappeared. And the trend of technology is probably going to take more of them. So that's obviously a problem. Then the response to the credit crisis with quantitative easing has created this massive increase in asset prices. Well, that is something that is unlikely to change until we have some significant denouement in terms of the quantity of debt outstanding and the willingness of governments to engage in yield curve control and modern monetary theory could potentially delay it somewhat further. The easy way to get housing prices down is to build more of them. And it looks quite likely that that is exactly what's going to happen. And lumber prices now are finding support in the region of the trend mean, having unwound more than half of the accelerated advance during the lockdowns. We've had this incredible move in technology this year. But it's not all technology. It was primarily the stay-at-home champions. Now the NASDAQ has at least paused in the region of 12,000. And the move we had this week was certainly dynamic in nature. Then we've also had this really incredible move in semiconductors, and it's mirroring the performance of the NASDAQ. Taiwan Semiconductor has been one of the clearest beneficiaries of this trend. They have experienced massive demand growth because of the stay-at-home phenomenon, where lots of people have had to buy new computers, new tablets, new electronic devices, new ways of trying to keep themselves entertained, whether that has been with my own family. We bought the Oculus VR set, and we had a lot of fun with it in the early parts of the lockdowns. But the point is that the other source of major demand was from Huawei, and they bought millions of units for their build-out of 5G before US sanctions hit. And I don't wonder whether that is another example of how 2020 is quite similar to the Y2K phenomenon. That issue with lockdowns, and then of the ban on selling equipment to Chinese operators, that's quite similar to what happened in the year 2000 or in 1999, because there was this clear desire to make sure that all purchases had been already been made before the calendar ticked over. And that calendar effect was also one of the factors in supporting the extraordinary sales growth that Taiwan Semiconductor has been reporting. That also fed through into anticipation that 5G infrastructure development would represent a similar growth stretch for the rest of the world. It might do, but the rest of the world doesn't have the same time pressure. They don't have to buy that infrastructure by a set date. That suggests that we may not see the same kind of demand growth coming through from the semiconductor sector in the next few quarters as we did at the beginning of the lockdowns. And that's also one of the factors that could have a deleterious effect on some of the stay-at-home champions. So when we look at, for example, one of those indices, there has been a massive migration into stay-at-home sectors. And those that did best were the cloud computing companies, because the ETF for cloud computing is almost identical in shape to that stay-at-home sector. And they've had a front loading of purchases into 2020, but where is the growth going to come from in 2021 when people have already made the big upfront purchase? They'll obviously have the recurring income from the subscription business model, so that will at least help to sustain them. But the valuation on some of these companies has been rather extraordinary. It's also represented a clear acceleration for companies like Microsoft. Now, they just recorded another in a long succession of quarterly profit gains, or I think, sorry, revenue gains of in excess of 10%. So there has certainly been a loss of momentum over the course of the last 6 months, and it's just about unwound its overextension relative to the trend mean. Now, it has a history of dipping below the trend mean, but it's never sustained a move below it in all of the bull market up since 2011. Apple has definitely taken a gamble in terms of not supplying a charging cable with their new phones. I think there's a lot of people that is the kind of niggly detail that will just tick people off. And the share is consolidating below the 140 level and unwinding its overbought condition relative to the trend mean. So there is certainly potential that we could have a re-rating or rotation out of the champions of 2020 and into some of the laggards. And the potential for commodity demand growth to pick up in the emerging markets next year, and the potential for the emerging markets ETF to do better is also, I think, tied to how China comes out of the coronavirus. The MSCI Emerging Markets Index has been going sideways for the last 12 years. Now, I don't think that this is the best way to invest in emerging markets, but there are huge numbers of investors that simply buy ETFs that are backed by MSCI indices. So perceptions towards emerging markets are likely to be influenced by the performance of this index. And if it can break up and through 1200, that is going to be a green light for interest in emerging markets overall. I think that's quite likely to be the case in 2021. I really do believe that we are coming to the end of the coronavirus hysteria, even with the rising number of cases and the rising number of hospitalizations. We have to remember the fact that we know more about it today. We know more about how to treat people. We know more about who is at risk. And we are on the cusp of having both treatments and preventative measures for the global population, and that we are well past the peak, and are the perhaps peak is the wrong word. We are past the worst effects of the coronavirus, and we're progressively moving towards what a recovery scenario will look like. But that recovery scenario is predicated on access to liquidity. In order to regain the position that economies were in at the beginning of 2020 is going to require a great deal of liquidity. It's going to require a willingness to make money available via credit. And that's something that is obviously going to represent a challenge in terms of the ability of governments to fund it. We're at a point, I think, in terms of the markets where there is a significant transition. When we look at the performance of the energy sector, well, Chevron, for example, came through today with a profit. It had a small upside key reversal yesterday, and then it finished higher in here today. So it may be in the process of putting in a higher reaction low. Some of the energy companies will prosper, and Chevron at least is well off its lows from back in March. Then, when we think about Royal Dutch Shell, they produce more gas than oil, and they are increasing their dividend. Now, obviously, the share collapsed when they cut their dividend, but they are now starting to raise the dividend once more, and this share is incredibly depressed. When people were willing to buy it at 2,500p, then there's a grave reluctance to pay for it when it is less than 1,000. But if they can sustain dividend growth, then the share is a bargain at these levels. But it's only a bargain to the extent that the energy sector is likely to be the scapegoat used to rationalize the massive spending on the Green New Deal. The business models of companies like Sunrun are very dependent on interest rates, and government bond yields are rising, and now the share has pulled back for 4 consecutive weeks. The epicenter of risk today is in the private equity sector. That's part of the reason why we're getting this rash of IPOs. There has been a massive surge in the number of IPOs in the last 6 months, because private equity understands how interest rate sensitive their investments are. So they're cashing out today. There is a phenomenal amount of money on the sidelines from private equity, but those are different funds. They are sitting on the sidelines waiting for clear value opportunities. The business model that has prevailed and has been most successful since 2008 has been to capture market share at any cost. The companies that have been able to capture market share have knocked out their competition. They've created virtual monopolies, and then they have been able to acquire all of the speculative interest, which has helped them to sustain their businesses. Tesla was able to knock out Carmacar back in 2010, and then was able to capture the credit or the carbon credits market, and that has sustained it throughout its entire evolution. And it will continue to sustain it as long as governments are willing to force competitors to fund the evolution of alternatives. And that is one of the reasons why the solar sector, the wind sector, and the hydrogen sectors have all been doing so very well. But the other point is that all of that business model is inherently dependent on interest rates. The entire private equity business model and alternatives generally are completely reliant on access to very cheap liquidity that they can leverage at an extraordinary rate in the private markets, which are not marked to market. Therefore, if we had to think about where risk really resides, it's actually not in the listed sector to nearly the same extent as it is in the private equity sector. And that, I think, is something we need to pay attention to, because if we do not get clear and substantive action to contain the expansion of government bond yields, then that will have significant knock-on effects for a whole range of assets. In fact, the size of that risk is why I think we are going to have a clear and substantial move to contain the increase in government bond yields. I think that will be the rationale for the next substantial round of liquidity provision. And I think, and I do apologize for going on a little longer than normal, but I wish all the best to all of you.